Boom. Live. How's everybody doing? Welcome to another A&R session where today we're going to discuss PROs, performance rights organizations, and music publishing, and all of those things work together. Have an incredible lineup today, and we can just go around and everyone can introduce themselves, and I'll start to my left with Mr. Soul Train, Sean Glover.
Hey, you're for a stone groove, baby. No, my name, I'm not Don Cornelius, but my name is Sean Glover. I'm director of industry relations at Sound Exchange, and we collect and distribute your digital streaming royalties.
And we'll get into all that, what that means in a few. Next to my right, Tab.
So, Tab, SVP at DMG Music Publishing. A&R, Def Jam for 8 years, songwriter, former songwriter, still a songwriter, my boys. That's what's up.
Kobe.
Hey there, Kobe Brown, Senior Director of Business Affairs, Music Licensing at Sony Music. Basically, identifying and clearing music before it hits the streets so that everyone gets paid properly and we're not working to enrich the people whose rights we infringed on.
Very important. Who's next? Ian.
What's up, guys? Ian Holder, VP Creative, A&R, and Sony ATV Music Publishing. I'm based out in New York. Prior to here, I was at BMI for 10 years. Got my start on the label side. Working with the top songwriters in the business. Always looking for more. So happy to be here.
Byron.
What's going on, everybody? Byron Wright, currently Senior Director, A&R. I also was at BMI 10 years and then transitioned to publishing at Warner Chappell Music. So I'm a talent songwriter, producers, and I'm basically.
Of course, last but not least, the Queen.
What's up, everybody? I'm Catherine Bruton. I ran R&B hip hop for BMI and had the pleasure of working with Ian and, ironic, Byron said 10 and 10 with both of these guys. So it's really, I guess, full circle to be able to have a platform that we can talk about kind of synergy and certainly support kind of what Eddie has going on here today. So that's
all. Thank you. Again, this is a very important panel, very important information, especially as we, you know, move forward with what the new normal will look like in our business. And, you know, in some of these conversations and some of these post panels that we've been doing, I've been getting a lot of emails and texts about, hey, can you talk about music publishing? We don't understand it. Can you talk about PROs? We don't really understand it. So here we are. And, you know, I want to go on and continue with Miss Catherine. And why don't you just let everybody know specifically what is a PRO and what, you know, what do you do on a daily basis?
So the performance rights organization is, I think for people who often say a publisher, we're not a publisher. We don't own copyright. We pay creators for their works once they're performed in any type of public forum. What I will say is, you know, we've become the gatekeeper to some extent. I think the role of a PRO was pretty straightforward in my early career. You sign a writer, they start making money, they get paid, and then they're all, you really don't have a real ongoing relationship. And as the publishers grew and the bandwidth for creatives kind of became more of a demand in terms of their needs, we started to take on the role of not only connecting them with writers, producers with writers, and writers with producers, there was also a lot of consultation, meaning putting them with lawyers, helping them find managers. So it became really almost functioning in the role of a publisher and to some extent, a label, but we're not. And I want to say that and say that clearly. So don't call me after this, like, Adam, you said you were functioning as, that's not who we are. That's not what our mandate is. But I think because the publisher's role, although I think there's still a lot of publishers who do, you know, the sessions and really handle the high flying fruit, there's still a lot of newer guys coming in the game who we know are skilled and we know will be somebody. We take the time to do a lot of the development that's not being done once they are on the radar of a publisher, and certainly to a lesser extent, the record label. So we pay for their works, and we don't own copyright. Our deals are 2 years. You sign, you get any type of radio play, digital performances, syncs, you make money. It's really simple. And we have become probably the most sustainable income stream. You generally will get a publishing check, and in most cases may not never see another check. And I may not maybe in trouble with the publishers, but it's rare that you're every 2 years negotiating a publishing deal. That doesn't it's a probably 3-5% that will see money that frequently. The PROs, if you make it, you can come back and get it. In some cases, you can have a balance and they will renegotiate a deal. But it's all based on what we consider pipeline, which is what most deals are done.
How are you supporting your writers and your producers right now in this time of need? I'm sure you're getting lots of questions.
We're busy. I want to say Bank of America when I answer the phone. We're looking at, you know, and trying to sustain our people. BMI's distribution was paid early. Our competitor had some trouble paying their writer distribution. Don't know the details, so I don't want to have people questioning me on it because I don't know the details other than a letter went out that said, hey, we don't have money and we're not going to pay. Our system is different. And I think what people have to understand is we are different. We provide the same services, but our payout's different. Our schedule is different. We're paying 3 quarters behind. ASCAP is paying what they collect goes out the door the next quarter. So that was a bit of a quagmire for them. I think they'll probably recover and be back in a good footing, but I think it's important that, you know, you understand how the money flows and what the differences are in looking at it. So we're supporting. I'm busier than ever. I say this and wholeheartedly is I've probably been more productive home the last 4 weeks. We've been working from home now 4 weeks than I've been in probably 10 years because I've been focused and really allowing myself to be scheduled and not being pulled in 100 different directions and then being called out of the office. I'm home and getting, you know, a lot done. And I'm talking to everybody a lot more these days. And I'm talking A to Z. I'm on the phone with every week strategizing.
Yeah. I'm sure that we all have seen an increase in phone calls and obviously Zooms. I know I have, and I'm about tired of them. So
same here.
Segueing to the publishing aspect of things, and Tab, I'll let you start. You know, kind of give us your view and your perspective as an OG who, as you mentioned earlier, is a songwriter and understands the importance of a PRO, who understands the importance of publishing, and you've been at publishing companies, you've been at record labels, and now back at BMG. So why don't you kind of give your perspective on it?
I'm just going to kind of piggyback off some of the things that Catherine said. I think, you know, a lot of us got our start in Atlanta. So Atlanta's very unique. Atlanta's Black Nashville, for lack of a better term to me. So what Catherine and Byron and Ian and her whole team initially were doing was like, it's a very grassroots level. You know what I mean? They were our first big meeting. You know what I mean? Every writer in Atlanta, their first official meeting usually is with, you know, was on Peach Street in a BMI office. And, you know, if you were able to get a, you know, stop by Tricky's, you know, Tricky Studio, get a hit with Trick, with Dream, or Dallas, or Jermaine, or Rico, all everybody, then you would get a call from somebody from New York or somebody from LA. You know what I mean? And then that's when the attorney game gets there and things get a little weird. And that's when all of a sudden, you know, it gets a little different. And then kind of moving forward from the grassroots level of a PRO, because I think what Catherine and them are doing really is undervalued and people don't really understand it. Because, well, now that John has actually put up a brick and mortar in Atlanta, it's going to possibly change some things for us. And it should have happened a long time ago, to be honest.
Decades ago.
It should have happened a long time ago. I don't know why, because when you go to Nashville, every publishing company's got a, you know, but that's a whole other conversation, and you know how I feel about that. But what I'm saying, what they were providing real service was was to me, which was so dope. So eventually you get to write a hit record, you get a call from somebody from like Ian or myself, and, you know, and then the check comes and the conversation comes and the bidding wars get going and this and that. And then at that point, it's to me, it becomes about service. So I think one of the things that I always like to tell writers is that I've been a writer before. So as a publisher, to be honest with you, my publisher probably got me 25% of my cuts. So the majority of my cuts came from hustling, came from getting on planes, came from relationships, and you just kind of build your name. So publishers, to be honest with you, we the good ones do provide a service, a little bit more grassroots. I mean, a little bit more, I guess I would say, upper level grassroots after what Catherine and those guys do. When you sign with us, there's a honeymoon period, like I said, okay, you know, we promise you the world, you know, at some point, and some of us deliver and some of us don't. So at that point, I think really what it comes down to is just for writers is, I always tell writers, you're your own publisher. At the end of the day, you have to be your own publisher. Just because you signed a check, don't stop the hustle. You know, it's funny, I had a writer have a medium hit the other day and start calling for plaques. I'm like, well, why are you worried about plaques? Go back in and go write another one. Like, you know what? The plaques will come. Just stop that. And, you know, it's funny because I said, I know that writer's from L.A. Atlanta writers don't worry about plaques. We just go back to the studio every day and keep grinding. And that's what I loved about it all. So, Eddie, I don't know if I answered your question or not, but that's what it is.
Absolutely. And I like those fancy plaques in your background. Looks like Alessia and Mary J.
Those are all
fancy.
Awesome.
Fancy.
Got me those either.
And just to, you know, talk some shit, who have you written records for?
I wrote Take Me As I Am for Mary J. Blige, which was a big record. I wrote Wild Things for Alessia, which was a top 10 pop record. Maya, B2K, I'm forgetting a lot of people. Britney Spears, Justin Bieber. A lot of people.
You forgot about this girl group named Destiny's Child?
Hey, yeah. I forgot about that. Big song, The Writing's on the Wall. Yeah. That paid. When albums used to sell.
Ian, why don't you give us your perspective, you know, from a publishing standpoint? And also I want, you know, Tab brought up a good point as well about setting, you know, Sony ATV recently setting up shop in Atlanta. If you can expound on maybe some of the rationale and why, you know, John Platt decided to do that.
Well, to go on that first, you know, I've been at Sony ATV for about 3 years now. And when I got there, it's crazy because I was always trying to make a big push that we should do something in Atlanta because it was such a void there in terms of major companies being missing. So Atlanta gives up so much in terms of talent, music, to the culture and everything. We don't give enough back. And I just think it was imperative, even since my start at Sony ATV, to try to build something and to try to establish something. So I used to always fight for us to at least get one room or to come up with a fund for something, which, you know, I did a couple songwriting camps, but, you know, to your point about John coming there, it took someone like John to really move the needle and really kind of say, no, this is needed now. And now we're going to do this. You know what I'm saying? This doesn't get done without John. So the studio we took over was Dreamin' Tricky's studio called Red Zone. We just announced.
A shout out real quick.
Sorry?
I helped build that building too. Just shout out to you. You know what I'm saying? Don't get it twisted.
I think there's so much history.
Let me keep it real with you.
Yeah. There's so much history. There's so many hits that came out of there. So just the fact that it's such a regarded piece of property, it's such a regarded space that we're taking over, it just means that much more. And Dreamin' Tricky are still gonna be involved. Like, they'll have a room. But it'll be our foothold in Atlanta. It'll be our office, and we'll start building out of there. So we're extremely excited. I can't express how many texts and calls from just our writers that are in Atlanta that hit me up saying, you know, I need in, or this is great, and this is, you know, just for the culture, it's amazing. So we're excited to really build that out. You know, the state of the climate that we're in with COVID kind of put a damper on, you know, us really kind of being able to sink our teeth in immediately. But as soon as the, you know, we get the smallest room or the smallest opening to kind of start really segmenting this and building it out, we're taking it. So that's that. And then on another level, in terms of what you know, what publishing means, I think Tab touched on a lot of great points. But I think from a business perspective, the best way to look at what a publisher does outside of the creative, I'll get to the creative in a second. I like to explain it as three tiers. We collect your mechanical royalties, we collect your performance royalties from BMI or ASCAP, and we're gonna solicit and exploit your catalog through sync, film, and TV. And those are the avenues that you make money in publishing. From a creative standpoint, I think Tab said it all. I mean, if you're lucky to have a great A&R, yeah, they'll keep you, you know, they'll keep you in sessions. You know, I love to look at it as a space of helping a songwriter build their network. So that's coming up with great collaborations between other songwriters, other artists, even other executives, and making sure they know who's who and who's working on what at any given point in time. I view my role as just making sure I'm spreading a lot of information and making sure from when we start a business relationship, no matter what, we're taking this progressive steps forward in the time that you've been with the company. But most importantly, I build around what the vision of the songwriter is. I think that that's most important. I wouldn't necessarily get into business with somebody if I had to create the whole vision for them. Because it defeats the purpose. Yes, I got to believe in them, but I want them to believe in themselves too. And I want them to take ownership on where they think that this could go. And I view my role as being able to fill the voids and adding to what their vision is at that given time.
Good job, Ian.
It's like a proud mom.
It is. Good job, Ian. I mean, Catherine knows, and a lot of people probably on this call knows, like a lot of my, you know, my wealth and knowledge and where I'm at, and, you know, in my career now, you know, I wouldn't be where I'm at without Catherine. It's just plain and simple. And Catherine has been a part of my journey. Actually, she's probably been the biggest part of my journey because I've spent 10 years at BMI, but I really was able to get my executive feet wet with Catherine and learned a lot. And, you know, her trees, her branches are spreading. You know, you got two people.
Clearly.
Clearly. You know what I'm saying?
There's a lot more out there.
So that, you know, for us, you know, for just, you know, executives in the business, but Black executives even more.
Men.
You know, don't forget
Black men. Because that's a challenge.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I believe, you know, a true wealth in an executive's career is what they're able to give back and what they're able to spread out. You know what I'm saying? You could have all the, you know, all the accolades and, you know, you could, your bank account could be great, but if you have, you know, branches from your tree that are blossoming and that are doing things, and most importantly, they're giving back, to me, that's the truest sign of success
in
business. And I only hope to replicate what Catherine has done for us.
Before, and kudos to Catherine, because again, you know, she has many of, you know, people and has mentored many of people and executives that have gone on to do different things, obviously, case in point with Ian and Byron. But Ian, I'd like you, you know, before we move on, I would love for you to kind of touch on some of the skills that you learned at BMI that you have been able to utilize and transition into your role now at Sony ATV.
Can I give him one point though before he jumps in there? He's one of the most phenomenal technicians of the craft. I think people want to do business but don't know how to do business. And I commend Ian for the quality of his work. A remarkably bright executive, always was really soft-spoken, not a rah-rah. One of the most balanced on the team. But again, a super, super dope clinician. Really, really smart. So sorry.
Thank you, Kat. What was your question again?
Sorry, I have to wipe the tears off.
Oh, shut up, buddy.
What are some of the skills that you know you learned at BMI under Catherine Tulage and has been able to, you've been able to transition into your role now at Sony ATV?
That's easy. Attention to detail, which is always something I still work on. How you talk to people, how you treat your relationships, how you stay engaged. You know, there's so many things that you probably wouldn't rate on the Richter scale that I don't, you know, just on paper, my job doesn't call for now, but it all adds up, you know, and it all means, you know, they're all tools that I use, even though it's not on paper, you know, I necessarily go to initially. So I think the biggest thing that jumps out and the biggest thing I take is attention to detail and how I move forward with just dealing with dealing and building my relationships within the songwriter community.
So, Byron, would love for you to answer that same question, seeing how you have you did a 10-year bid with Catherine at BMI as well. I'd love to get your perspective on that as well.
Hold on. And nailed it on the head. We both learned so much from Catherine, and I started working with her when I was fresh out of college. So coming out of college and joining BMI, that's definitely allowed me to build my platform, my foundation, to be able to move on and progress in the industry. Detail. Catherine definitely allowed me to flourish and to grow. She's never been the one to hold us back or anything. She always encouraged us to continue to grow and reach for higher heights. You know, Ian and I are great examples of that. I mean, everything we learned. Catherine always allowed me to sit in on her meetings, which a lot of people will hold back and they might not want you to get that firsthand knowledge. She always brought me in and I was a student. I mean, I think that's one of the most important qualities someone can have trying to get in this game is you have to always be willing to learn and be willing to listen. And that was kind of how I was able to grow. I was always listening to what she was saying, even when she thought I wasn't. I was always paying attention to her mannerisms and how she moved in a room, all which is so important. So those are just a few of the things I learned. I could go on and on about, you know, what I've learned from CB, but I'll just leave it at that. I can't hear you.
I think everybody's muted.
I muted myself when talking. So Byron, one of the things I also wanted to, you know, have you expound on, you know, we have a lot of college students that tune in to these and mm-hmm. you, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're fresh out of University of, was it West Georgia?
Georgia.
And transition right into your role. Can you give a little insight on how that all happened?
All right. Yeah. Catherine, we talk about this story all the time. I mean, I worked for the city of Atlanta for a brief period before I went to BMI, but I was always, you know, trying to make my way into the music business. The story is I met Catherine at a music conference. So, you know, going out and being on the scene and being in the right places was important for me. I live in Atlanta. I grew up in Atlanta. So I always felt like being in Atlanta gave me the upper hand as far as networking and being in the right rooms and meeting the right people. So I ultimately met Catherine at the Atlantis Music Conference. It was a big conference that used to happen every year here in Atlanta. And, you know, she'll tell her I had a suit on. I had my resumes. I was dressed to the T. And I really went about it as it was a business, because everything in the music business is mostly business, which I think a lot of people need to realize. I approached her after her panel, and, you know, I didn't want to be like everyone else. I knew that. I wasn't trying to bombard her like everyone else, you know, and I just wanted to make my presence known, get in and get out. Well, fortunate enough for me, she allowed me to walk her to her car, and at that point, I was able to give my two-minute spill, you know, on what I was looking to do, what I'd done and been doing in Atlanta, you know, my internships at the record labels here. So I just feel like you have to be creative and try to figure out your own way. Like, there's no one particular way to get in the business, and that's kind of how I moved. I kind of just wanted to do things, you know, my way, and, you know, it worked out. You know, I always attribute it to God, because a lot of things that happened in my life, I had no control over, first of all. So it was God putting people like Catherine in my life to be able to do the things that I've been doing and being prepared to handle the jobs that are presented to me. But, you know, definitely I owe a lot of it to CB for believing in me from a young age. When I was 23 years old, you know, and became an executive at BMI. And, you know, she took a chance on me, and I always wanted to make sure I did what I needed to do to represent for her, for taking that chance on me.
So basically, Catherine's the plug.
No. I think to that point about opportunity meets chance, we're all in a position where we can give back and really change the trajectory of people's lives. And I never took for granted me being the first Black officer at BMI and opening an office as a Black female and being a check writer in Atlanta that, you know, could change people's lives. So I understood the responsibility, but I didn't abuse the privilege. But I also knew that because I made it, I couldn't be comfortable. I had to make sure that I hired smart people like Ian and Byron, who were certainly capable of doing what I did. But I also, and they will tell you, they knew that I don't care how smart you are, you're not gonna work harder than me. And I led by example. So I want this generation to understand that it's a different day and time. And the chances that you will meet people are few and far between, because we've become more segregated than ever. And I think COVID is going to create even more segregation. So how do you now, in a space where everything, social media, I feel like people sell their soul for what they believe is fame, and there's no real sustainability to it. How do we now sustain when we can't go hustle in the streets and run up on people, because that's not going to be okay anymore? So I think we all, I learned, you know, from people like Ian and Byron and Wardell, I learn from them every day. But I know that also with each day that I walk into that office or now in my home and I engage my crew, I'm pushing myself to learn more and to make sure that I can extend the olive branch and hiring kids of color that are able to get into our internship program. So there's a lot of nuances to it. In a business that you think where Black music is really doing well, we are getting our fair share of the pie. It's just not the case. A lot of our buildings are being ran by people who are not really consumers of our music. They just decide based on analytics how it's going to be paid for. So we have to be smarter and than we were maybe when I started. And I consider myself pretty smart. It's a whole different landscape that we must really dive into and understand the nuances of it, or we're going to continue to get a small piece of the pie.
I want to come back to a few things that you said in a few minutes. I want to give Sean and Kobe a chance to really kind of dive into what they do. Sean, Sound Exchange. Give us the lay of the land, man, of Sound Exchange.
Hey, man, y'all got me. I saw a warm and fuzzy in here. I'm going to jump on to Catherine Bruton. I'm going to go on the CB train. You know what? This time is giving me, you know, a chance to give people their flowers while they can still smell them in it. And look, Byron, as someone who has sat on a panel with Catherine and has walked with her afterwards, you know, it's like opening up for Michael Jackson. I know what that's like. And listen,
I'm getting off, y'all.
There's a lot of gatekeepers, and everybody on this panel can attest to this, in this business, that really get off on being gatekeepers and don't like to share the knowledge. And I, you know, Catherine and I, our companies are not in competition. We share information and we help our constituents out when we can. And she definitely shares that game. So that's just one thing that I've always remembered and stuck out about her. So I'm gonna jump off right now. Okay, enough of that.
Thank you.
But no, so just in a nutshell, I mean, Sound Exchange, we're kind of the new guys on the block compared, you know, as far as PROs go. But in short, we collect and distribute the digital streaming royalties. So all the music that is streamed on the web, cable, and satellite, with satellite just being one company, SiriusXM, But and even the AM/FM terrestrial radio stations that rebroadcast or have simulcasts on the web, we collect by law, we collect those funds and we distribute them to the artists directly, which is very important, and the copyright owner, or for those that hear, whoever owns the masters. We've been around for maybe 12 years. In short, what Congress did was, as you know, on FM, AM/FM radio, there's no performance right. The United States is one of, you know, a few countries, really four countries that don't have a performance right. So when you hear a song on the radio, you know, RSPCT by Aretha, Respect by Aretha Franklin, when you hear that on AM/FM radio, Aretha gets zero for performing that song. Otis Redding gets paid, his estate gets paid because he wrote it. And everybody else associated with that song gets paid, but not the performer. So what Congress did not so long ago, when I call it when the music industry flipped on its head, when everything became digital, they said, hey, we kind of screwed up with this. We don't have this right, but for this going forward, these royalties, these type of streams should be paid royalties. So that's how Sound Exchange was born and birthed. And then there's a lot of other nuances with that.
Sorry, I keep muting myself because there's an echo.
Okay.
One moment.
Okay.
Kobe.
Yeah. So I'm over in business affairs at Sony Music, and I like to equate songs to, you know, one of the greatest assets they say you can ever own is a house. And I think a lot of people who are listening, I'm assuming most people are college students or young aspiring artists, producers, executives. Imagine the song that you create being the same as a house. And whether it be the record, meaning you're the performer, or the song, meaning you're the songwriter, or both, the royalty that you will receive is part of owning a house. So what I do, or what my responsibilities are at Sony, are to review songs to make sure there are no infringements or things that may belong to someone else in a song, to make sure we get those permissions before we put the record out. Because what you will come to learn is that people who write great songs, those songs come back again and again and again, over and over again. But if you're writing a song and you're not getting the proper permissions and making sure that you have full ownership of that song or some type of control based on your contribution, then 20, 30, 40 years from now, you're not going to be able to benefit from that. And I, you know, I don't like to be long-winded, so I'll make this really fast. I've had the fortune of meeting a lot of great songwriters along the way, because I was actually introduced to sampling through working in A&R and working with artists and making records that were sample-based, and then learning, oh, you have to go get permission. And it's funny, I formed a relationship with a guy named Doug Gibbs at one point, and he's famously sampled in Jay-Z's song Cry. So I asked him, well, you know, what was going on when you heard about that record? And he explained he had this nonprofit to help drug addicted teens and things of that nature. And the nonprofit was running out of money. And suddenly he got a phone call, and that was a huge, you know, six-figure check when it was all said and done, when the blueprint was released and had its success. And he thought it would never happen. It was just a one-off record, probably the biggest record in his 30-song catalog that he had written in the early 70s, that found this new life in the 2000s, the early aughts. He recently texted me one day and he's like, it happened again. And I'm like, I know. And he was talking about Drake now sampling the same record, the Jay-Z sample for Song Cry. So you're talking about, you know, properly owning a home or a song in this case guarantees that, you know, not only will you be able to take care of yourself, but it's the money that sends children to college, pays for weddings, pays for retirements, all sorts of things. And a lot of young artists don't necessarily consider these things, because what we're chasing in a lot of cases is internet fame and likes and acceptance and notoriety, as opposed to really building some type of wealth based on the ownership of a song.
Perfect. One of the things, and I, like I said, I wanted to get back to a few things that Catherine mentioned. What are some of the resources and things you guys are doing at your respective companies to keep in touch with your creatives, your songwriters, your producers? You know, obviously we're all really in the same position, so we'd love to kind of hear from each, you know, perspective what you guys are doing. and anyone can start.
I'll jump in on my end. I mean, I think we had a sidebar on this before we jumped in with everyone else. For me, Zoom life is the new life. You know, and I'd also say this, I love to find opportunities in, you know, not the greatest situation. And I'd say the opportunity in this is, in a weird way, it's actually gotten me a lot closer with a lot of people that I wouldn't even have thought to. And the reason being is because, you know, I don't have to wait, you know, a month before I go back out to LA or, you know, I don't have to wait, you know, a couple months before I'm able to go back to Europe to meet with some of my songwriters or some of my executives, or some other, you know, any network that I have all over the world. You know, I'm able to do this in a split second. And, you know, for a company like Sony, you'd think that we were kind of ahead of the technical wave, but we weren't. You know, we only now started getting set up with Microsoft Teams maybe about 3 weeks before, you know, COVID really took a hit. And so you'd think like a company that has such a, is really built half of it, at least half of its strength based off of technology and stuff like that, we're late to the game. So this has forced us to really kind of open up. You know, my fiance works in tech. This is something that they do on a regular basis before this all hits. So now it's forcing us to really kind of get hit with technology in terms of how we communicate and stay in touch with the community, the creative community. But in some ways specifically that I've been able to do it is literally doing Zoom meet and greets with artists and writers who, you know, from a standpoint probably wouldn't have been able to do this, period, because you wouldn't have had the time to have, you know, there wouldn't have been the exact opportunity that they're in the same city. You know what I'm saying? So sending tracks back and forth, having meetings on Zoom and being able to, you know, share screens and share music that way in real time. It really kind of trims a lot of fat for a lot of the creative stuff that I need to do. And we've made the best out of it.
Anybody else want to jump in?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I think the industry was built on a lot of, I think smoke and mirrors when you talk about infrastructure. I think there's this belief that everything's seamless and, you know, we're not brick and mortar. We are in the building standpoint, but that everything's super high tech. And I think every company struggled. You know, we don't have the cloud because there's some belief that it's too, you know, there's too many liabilities with respect to people being able to get in and grab content. They had to rethink this in COVID. Again, we had Microsoft Office, but it wasn't used as a tool. Zoom, we didn't have access to. But what I love about what COVID has done, as sad as it is that people had to lose their lives, I think globally we have become too dependent on a movement and not being cognizant of the fact that sometimes these types of moments are really, you're present. People have to be present, because if we were coming home from work, how many of us really would be focused enough to sit down and do this? So I think there's a real lesson that's being taught to everybody who really are paying attention, that as a business, we needed change. And I think we needed to really fundamentally start to operate differently. I'm talking to Nashville writers. I talked to Dallas Davidson and a big country artist who wanted to collab with John Legend. I was able to call Hassan Byron, connected me and connect them about a song he wanted to put out. So these things were happening, but the expedience in which things are happening now is amazing because people are available. Kenny Chesney, I signed, dear friend. He was about to go out on a tour. He said, Catherine, I'm going to lose $80 million this year. I have 100 people. I want to make sure my people are good. But we will survive, and I will go back next year and regroup. So life lessons, nobody's immune from this. I hope our community reset. And I think the value system that's been set by the hip hop community, my prayer is that we all take a look, and I say, I don't do hip hop, I sign everybody, and we all deal in this space. But I think we have to reset our value system, because I think we went down a rabbit hole a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you hit on something very important, is that the live component is going to be, and I've spoken to a lot of my friends who are at various.
No more, as we know.
As we know, the live business is going to change. I think it's going to force a lot of touring artists to, you know, even rethinking going to clubs when clubs are back open and getting those.
But it was,
you know,
time for that to change. Like
it's a lot of the live is going to change, and so obviously from an income and revenue standpoint, I think that's why PROs are going to be so important. Music publishing is going to be so important,
because people now are looking at us to supplement that loss. But I had this conversation again with Kenny, and I said, "Hey, how do you recover?" He said, "I can't worry about money I didn't never made." He said it was projected to do this, but I now have to focus on what is my new opportunity to replace this income. And I thought to myself, how brilliant are you? You're thinking ahead of the game and not worrying about what you didn't make. And I think we have to embrace that concept. What is the new medium by which we have to look at to make money, that really touring, movies, all of that will probably be a year or so before we can really resume any type of normal production?
Yeah, I mean, listen, general licensing is going to be down because bars and big restaurants and are not open. Sync income is going to be down because production houses are not open. Tab, I would love to get your perspective on, you know, from a publishing standpoint, you know, A, what you guys are doing at BMG to help support, you know, some of your writers, and B, as I mentioned, a lot of the publishing income is going to be decreased over the next, let's just say, 6 months. How are you working through that with your writers and producers and helping them? Hold on.
I've signed some artists who are about to go on tour, and I think one of the cool things that we were able to do is step up and just sort of help cover some of the losses that they were about to incur on going on tour, like when they couldn't go on tour. So we stepped up as a publisher and helped out a lot of writers, artists, and said, hey, you know, we'll help some of the shortfall. So it's like, I think that is the role of the publisher in this pandemic is, you know, it's like we're all family now, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it takes a village and we all need each other. And it's like, none of us saw this coming, obviously. So we all kind of got to figure out how we can just best support this. And so I think that was one of the cool things that we were able to do, was step up and help a lot of the artists who are about to go on tour. Like, you know, there were a lot of artists who were going to drop albums, you know, first quarter, second quarter. And this happened. And, you know, at that point, you kind of just got to hunker down and say, how can we do this? You know, and I felt bad because, you know, I had artists who were, this was their moment, like getting ready to go on like big global tours, opening up for Billie Eilish and going on their own tours. And, you know, there was a lot of that was going on. And, you know, you see this is your moment, and all of a sudden this comes and it kind of takes the wind out of your sails. So a lot of us were having to figure out how to supplement and just kind of just help you weather the storm. So we were able to do that in terms of touring. In terms of how we're structuring the business, I mean, you know, pretty much Ian and Big John are signing everything for him. So whatever they leave for the rest of us.
That's the same at Cobalt. Whatever they get, you know, we just fighting for the scraps.
Whatever has to leave for the rest of us, you know, I think the key for us now is like I always think for me, and this is no jokes aside, but it's like I try to get in early and discover and sign and be there early. So I think my signing process hasn't changed. I'm never going to be in the bidding war. I'm never going to enter the bidding war. It's all good. Y'all can add that. You know what I mean? So I sign. I try to develop and sign early. So, you know, I'm here for the $250,000, $300,000 writers and artists. You know what I'm saying? So for me, that's my price point. That's where I get down at. That's where I like that's the world I like to live in, to be honest with you. I love discovery, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? And that comes from being at a record label too. It's like you know, it's never about research for me. It's about how you feel and how you know, how you care. And I think we all the same way. I'm just giving Ian a hard time because he has a big checkbook. But at the end of the day, it's like, for us, it's still the same. You know, I'm signing and I'm figuring it out. I probably like the rest of these guys, like I've never been busier, to be honest with you. Literally, like, we are signing, we are aggressive, we are finding things. So this pandemic hasn't done anything but make us work harder and be more productive, to be honest with you.
Ian and Byron, are you guys at your respective companies, are you guys still being aggressive with signing, you know, for Ian, writers and producers, and Byron for artists?
For me, absolutely. I mean, I've actually started and closed deals throughout these times. So yeah, we are still being aggressive. But like Tab said, we've had to find ways to kind of, you know, get creative with things too. But that's been the beauty of it all, is that it's forced us to be creative. It's forced us to kind of find, how to really push the envelope without the skill sets that we're used to, you know what I'm saying? And like I said, through strategy comes great opportunity to really kind of change a lot of the ways we go about business, and not only change it, but improve on it. So we've been incredibly busy. Oddly, I wouldn't have been able to guess it, but actually more busier than even previously. And I don't even know how that's possible, but we have been. But I think it's the same across the board for the industry. I mean, I'll let Byron speak, and even to speak on that. Like, we just had to give an example, we Sony ATV and Epic had a full FaceTime, I mean, a Zoom meet and greet between both A&R staffs, with having like 40 people on a call. So, like I said, it's finding ways to kind of really stay connected, really deepen our relationships within the industry, both creatives and other executives, and you know, we're staying incredibly active throughout it all.
So, can AWOL and Cobalt get some FaceTime with Sony ATV or no?
Absolutely. I asked you for that already. So I asked you about that last week.
I know. Byron, your perspective, my brother.
Business as usual, just at home. I know Kobe will tell you, we've got a lot of music that's still coming out. A lot of music that is, we're still working on. With the whole studios, with us artists not being able to get in the studios, we've put studios in our artists' homes. A few of the newer acts that I've been developing, we've put home studios in so they can continue working, and just really getting more involved internally with the team. You know, I've been able to really get on the phone and really build with folks that, you know, everyone's always moving fast. And the call we had with Ian, with the Sony ATV team, you know, we're really finding different ways to be productive during this time, because we all have time. So we're just using it to the best of our ability and making some positive things happen. So it's just, it's business as usual, just at home.
Dawn, I want to just get some perspective from the Sound Exchange standpoint, and, you know, had a few questions. So for somebody who hears their music on YouTube and other platforms, and they're registered with Sound Exchange, but they're not seeing any payments, can you give some perspective as to why they're not getting their payments?
Yeah, that's one of the number one questions we get. And it's because the license, the law that we administer for, is non-interactive. So it's radio-like, meaning that when you hear streaming, you know, streaming is either, you know, there's a lean-in approach or a lean-back approach, where you can just say, I want to hear music that sounds like this, or you can say, I want to, you know, you can sort of curate a little bit of what it is that is a little interactive piece. But for some stations, it's deemed non-interactive by law. But radio-like, but just in a digital platform. So the listener has no control over what they hear. Just like the radio, you may call and request a song, even though they still do that, but you can call and request a song, but you're at the mercy of the PD. So when you hear your song on an artist hears a song, I get this 80 million times a day when I'm out, or somebody reaches me, I heard my song on it was in a jingle, or it was here, it was there, it was in a why don't I see it on my Sound Exchange check? It's really simple. It's anything streamed on the web, cable, and satellite. So anything that requires eyeballs, that takes us out. But I want to go back to the other question, though, is that my day-to-day, I think like I think Byron was saying it. It's just I have never worked as much in my life. I think Ian was saying they get more out of me than they had ever gotten out of me, mainly because of the situation. But like Catherine and I think Tab was saying, I think it is such a good like artist. That first week they was sweating. This the second week they were like, yo, I didn't just make $30,000 in my bedroom. So the creatives are, the juices are flowing. Like we're going to come out of this, and not just music. I think everything is going to be different and reimagined. Like big corporations can't say you can't work from home anymore. That shit out the door. I don't see corporate real estate rebounding from this. It is much cheaper. I'm not going to pay somebody. I'll pay you more to stay at home and get more work done and commute for 2 hours or 4 hours, depending on who it is. So corporate real estate is going to be dead. And maybe we can use that land for homeless or whatever. We do something good with that space. But the artists that I, you know, one of the big things that I have to do is there's a big metadata problem. It's not just the Sound Exchange problem, it's just the music industry in a whole. So there's a lot of recordings that we research. We have a department that we call them scrubbers. They actually scrub data, clean it up, and find out who owns what tracks. And those tracks earn money. They're not always reported to us in the right way. So there's a lot of balances. There's some unpaid balances. So I have to find these people, but get people to register to get this money out of the way. This new time, everybody at home, like, it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, because they know my ass is at home too. So it's a double-edged sword. But it's really good, you know, because I'm like the anti-bill collector. If I'm calling you, I got money for you. You know, it's a good call. Or you've moved or wired and bounced back or something. So this is a great time. Artists, creatives are being way creative, and we, if I can speak candidly, they're always going to figure it out. You know, we always going to figure it out. We're going to eat. So I'm loving this time. And I think the creatives are now. There's the other people in the live experience you were talking about, Eddie. Like, I know those guys who build the Jay-Z stage and break down the Jay-Z stage and go to the Rihanna stage. I know those people. I know I ate with them. I know their families. It's going to be difficult for them to sort of figure out that live experience and what that worked. But we'll figure it out, like you guys are talking about, smaller venues. This versus thing that Tim and Swizz is doing is incredible. Like, we the only people that can break Instagram. Like, we the only ones that can do that. The content that we make and stuff, we the only people that can do that. So we gonna figure it out, and it's going to evolve. It's always going to evolve into something else.
And I think to that point, I think we've seen us, the Black community, really set the tone, even in a pandemic, with some of the content that we're seeing on some of the platforms. So I think our resilience, just because of our DNA and, you know, how we were built, we will survive. We have come through many pandemics and things that really should have wiped us out. But I think the beauty in now and where we are now is we all have to cast the bigger net. If you're dependent on a building for sustainability, go ahead and you're not gonna last. And if this doesn't really make us all look at every aspect of how we make money, how we spend money, how we invest our time, then again, day job is your future. And that's fine, because we all have one. But that should not be the pinnacle. That should not be the bar. We should always be aspiring to have multiple streams that we depend on to support our lives and livelihood. So we will survive this, but it's going to be a new footprint in the game. And content is always going to be king. We've seen this time and time again, but we will see it disseminated in a different way. And just like digital leveled the playing field, we were always told, oh, Black music doesn't really play as well as pop. What is pop? I don't even know that's mm-hmm. that's been the big scam of all scams, but that's another conversation. Then digital started happening, and there's billions of streams, and now we are the most consumed genre, which I think was always the case, but buildings were able to spin what they wanted to be popular. So we have to know the business aspect and know the nuances and the backstories. You can't get in a game where you don't understand the game. So I think it's important for those who are listening, understand the game, understand the business of music. It is a business when it's all said and done, but also understand that even if you're making money in music, is that enough? The pandemic demonstrated it's not enough. Nope. There are billionaires who are in trouble right now.
I also want to say this. You brought up something that's very important, and I would be remiss that we are a very resilient people, and my dad brought this to my attention, and this is totally off topic, but black people don't scare easy. Like, you know, we got to see some shit. Like, we done survived a bunch of stuff. But I do want us to take this virus very seriously. Like, we need to see the towers being knocked down. We need to see something that's got to be tangible. And we're used to overcoming stuff, but we're the most people that are dying from this this virus, and I want us to take this serious.
Please, and spread that message. This is not a game. Too many Black people are dying, and young people are dying.
Especially in Atlanta.
Oh, it's ridiculous. But all the great stuff, and Tab and Byron knows this, but all the great stuff that Atlanta has done, they also on their watch, there's a lot of foolishness that have permeated out of this city that, again, culture is what they call it. I call it foolishness. I think it is somehow set the tone for who we are as a people. You are somebody in Atlanta, you got to be a housewife. I'm not. I have a real job. And yeah. So we have to separate fact from fiction. And social media has driven fiction, and somehow it's became factual. Know the difference, people. And again, know that we have to create sustainable ways to be able to feed our families, and know that I can walk in tomorrow and be a mom and say, oh, you're good now. And I'm good with that. I had a mom who believed in legacy. Understand that in your plight for success, all the pictures and all the stuff that we see, 80% of it is smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. Ask somebody to show you a bank statement or how many homes they own. Forget the cars and the jewelry.
Eddie, if I can kind of add on to what Sean and Kevin said, I think what's also important is to realize that what these past 8 weeks, that's just the number I have in my head, have shown us is just how much our creativity obviously drives culture.
Everything.
But there's currency in culture, we know that, but the next move after COVID should really be creating and controlling the highways on which this culture travels.
Talk that talk.
I see a lot of people talking about the creativity, and
Kobe, you about to get us kicked off the zone.
No, listen, you see him looking around like
Kobe, you about to get us kicked off the zone, man. Eddie ain't bring us in.
I mean, Zoom being a great example. Last time I checked, it was 100.
Go ahead, talk it.
I'm pretty sure it's up. This is the currency that makes Zoom popular. It makes Facebook popular. It makes Instagram popular. And it's something to really consider. The next play is really creating the platforms, because we obviously have the sauce that is going to drive people to it. But if you're not creating the highway, then you really have no control over
how and when the money is made. Absolutely.
And there's so much. I mean, we could clearly sustain ourselves on these highways alone and our creativity combined. And, you know, we talk about technology after COVID. I did a little research. Radio was invented in 1920, 100 years ago. And think about how that changed the voice and face and possibilities of the Black community. In the music business, you have writers who will probably never leave their bedroom that will get placements just because they have the ability to upload a 4 or 8 bar chord progression. There are publishing companies, and I don't know if Sony ATV or BMG is one of them, that are actually signing writers now who never will go into a studio with Jay-Z, but will come up with the chords that will become a hit record. So again, that's one of the things that one of the ways technology will bring us together and build growth, but the real growth and real ability to empower us will be in creating some platforms through which these things can travel, be disseminated, and most of all, be traded on and commodified.
And I want, and to Eddie, who I respect so much, and in his new role, you know, we have to not be afraid to take a chance on our own people. we will, Buildings will spend money on half of a talent who's the other, and I'm going to use the other for this conversation. And then we'll sit in these meetings and we will yes them knowing that that deal is not fair, but a deal for somebody who's far greater and more competent, but we won't stand up. And I just can't, I will never be that person. So to Kobe's point, let's start figuring out the lane that allows us to employ our people, to empower our people, to be in a position where they're sitting at the table, or we will continue to get the crumbs that is that's left on the side because we are afraid, because I need my job, I have kids. Yeah, those days are over. Like we have to be scared, bold enough to say, this is not fair. And I'm okay if I have to put myself on the line. And Byron and Ian will tell you, I will never sit in a seat that I can't speak freely about what I think is fair. And I will defend what I think is fair. We've got to be more empowered in our positions to now start to level the playing field. Too many of them get fired and go to another building in a greater role. And then we're struggling to try to get somewhere when we've earned a seat at the table we are at, and then we get fired and then have to defend ourselves to get another seat when we shouldn't have really been removed from the previous one. Yeah, it's different. That's what I'm going to say.
And a lot of that starts with the information and being able to share the information, and more importantly, not being afraid to share the information amongst ourselves. Like, you know, for example, Ian and I have known each other since Sony Urban when he was an assistant and I was an intern, right? We've known each other for what, 14, 15 years? You know, I've known Kobe, you know, because you've been at Sony, what, 16, 17 years, Kobe?
16.
Yeah, and that's how I have my relationship with him. Sean, I don't even know Sean, like, from the sound exchange aspect. I know him because rocking, you know, being Common's right-hand man. And that, like, you know, Tab and Byron, and of course, Catherine, like, we all have a relationship. And to talk about the creativity and being able to be in this position, be in this pandemic, everybody being, you know, no one has a leg up on each other. Like, we can't go to the studio.
Level the playing field.
You know, we can't roll to the club and spend our corporate card. You know, Catherine can't go and spend her $10,000 corporate card, BMI corporate card, buying a bottle. $2. none of those things. So we're all at, you know, ground zero, for lack of a better term. And this is our time to be creative, which is why I started this platform. You know, the first time that I did this with all of the various ANRs was just really supposed to be a one-time thing, but the feedback was so incredible. And because, you know, I have a lot of these relationships where I can call Kobe, I can call Sean, I can call Byron or Catherine or Tab or Ian and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. Would you mind doing this? And everybody said, yeah, of course, let's do it. So, you know, being able to, again, share the information amongst each other, being able to be creative and being able to share that creativity is so key and so paramount. I want to start to get into some questions, but before we do, I want to put a scenario out there because, again, the information is so important. So in a hypothetical situation, I'm a brand new manager. I'm really a homeboy who has a friend who did a song and it went on SoundCloud and it's streaming crazy. And he called me and he said, would you manage me? I don't know shit about the music business. I just know that one of my homeboys put a song up called Hot Shit and it's streaming crazy. I have labels calling me. Byron's calling me. I got publishers calling me. Tab and Ian are calling me. What am I supposed to do as a brand new manager who has an artist, and I'll use that in quotation marks, who has put a song out? Also to that as well, the producer of that song used a sample from Splice. And is that cleared? Is that not cleared? How do we do splits? Like, so I want to just throw that scenario out and anybody can jump in. Like, what should be my first step as a manager to this new artist that I have?
Let me go first. Can I go first? Oh,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Good.
First thing this is the number one pitfall of this scenario you just made up as far from a sound exchange lens that we get. You make a song, you might just tweet it out. Once you send that song out in the digital space, there's a very good chance that it's going to go somewhere else some sophomore doing work study at some university somewhere is going to stream it on the little radio stations simply because you sent it to them. I'm going to get the logs, and then somebody going to pay us for it. And because you sent it out, you had no information on where I send the money, that money is going to sit there till we find you. I would say label your music correctly. Register with Sound Exchange and don't forget about it. And forget about it. And it will earn money. If it's the hot shit turns out to be the hot shit, you will get a check. But make sure we know who to pay, where to pay, and you know how much you want the IRS to take or not to take by not sending us a W-9. And I'm done. And I'll let the other experts take it from there.
Let me just say two things. I say no two managers are the same. So if you know, everyone has their strong points. The first thing I would recommend is find a mentor, whether that be the attorney or whether that be someone who's worked in the business or is working in the business who has some experience. Because as a new manager, and especially a homeboy who just is along for the ride, you're not going to know everything at all. The second thing is, because and I'm just touching on this because you asked about Splice. I think Splice and BeatStars and Looperman have one section that is probably the least read of all time, and that's the terms and conditions. And I wouldn't blame a lawyer, I mean, not lawyer, but I wouldn't blame a new manager for not knowing this. But anyone who's listening to this right now, whenever you go to those sites, because they become extremely popular, read the terms and conditions, and all of them will say to you, even though they hang themselves out as royalty-free services, they'll basically tell you, we make no representation or warranty that the stuff you're pulling from here is original. I think one of the greatest examples of 2019 was Lil Nas X's Old Town Road. He bought a track from a service called BeatStars, $25, $50 at the most. And of course, the record became successful. When you have a successful record, there's enough money to go around for everyone. But here's someone who bought a track for $50 or less, only to find out that the person who sold him the track had a sample that was in the track. So, I mean, nowadays things can be worked out a little better, and if there's more success, there's more leverage you may possibly have. But the greatest story I can ever think of, I guess there's two, one from the generation before me and one from, I guess, my generation. And I'll start with the one before me. Rapper's Delight, the reason that all of us are probably in this conversation right now, because there would be no hip hop industry without Sylvia Robinson. Look her up for those listening. Definitely Google someone. If you've ever made a dollar in hip hop, you need to know who that was. Rapper's Delight was a hip-hop record based on a song called Good Times by Sheik. None of the writers of Rapper's Delight receive a single penny because 100% of the song belongs to Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards because it was a sample that wasn't cleared. Fast forward some years, Peter Guns and Lord Tariq had a huge record. If you were in New York at the time, you understood the magnitude of that record. But because they didn't clear anything, $100,000 of their budget, when they finally got found, signed, immediately went to the sample group Steely Dan, as did all the publishing. So that record could be in the next Star Wars, and instead of the money going to the people who we know made it a hit, it'll go to someone else. So, like I said, the least read part of any of these sites is terms and conditions, and it's very simple to read, and it's the first thing you'll see when you go to the terms and conditions about the copyrights of those things that are on these sites.
So for me, a new manager who doesn't have skills as a manager is like calling an assistant a doctor because she's in the waiting room that can fill your paperwork out. I believe that so many people get got early on because they have vested interest in people who somehow got them noticed by introducing them to people. But I've also seen to the detriment of so many creators who have, you know, had deals with managers for years and years, and it hasn't been productive. So I don't believe in signing with friends because they're your homeboy and they paid your rent for 6 months. I say you pay them back and you arrange something so that they could maybe assist you along the way, but you give yourself a title because you've been in the mix. I don't believe in it. I say get a lawyer. Let your lawyer set the tone and build a team. And maybe he or she should work a year or two and learn the business before you take a title. That I've never seen any community take on, put people in positions that just because they are my friend, I don't care. I'm not having a friend operate on me. So why am I going to have a dude, Junebug, who came up in the community with me, who used to buy me weed, handle my business and go sit at the table and do deals for me? And he probably can't even balance his checkbook. Understand that how you set the tone of your business is how oftentimes you'll end up. It is absolutely pivotal early on that you find a lawyer to do the business.
Eddie, really? I just want to interject, and I'm sorry, Tab. I think that's definitely greatly important, but we should not underestimate the importance of empowering our people. Now, because the guy sat next to you, he shouldn't be running your career, but you realize every other community, I mean, you don't know how many ineffective executives they are in other there are from other communities that have jobs because they're a member of a community, or that manage artists because they're a member of the community. So I think it's important to identify who the best leader is.
Keep them in the place. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. But never forget that you have an opportunity in order to enrich other people the same way as Ian and Tab have, and Byron have, you know, spoken so poetically and truthfully about what Catherine was able to do for them.
Yeah, and again, but I think we have to, not to the detriment of our community, and I think to the Jewish community, they're grooming their kids to be whatever they need to be. And we don't have parents. A lot of times our, you know, kids are coming from communities that have been decimated by drugs and alcohol, the things that we all have to kind of take note of. And so I believe, and we've seen it, all of us have seen it. You have a crew come in and they don't even understand the language of the business, but they're making decisions, and the artist is looking to that person to decide their fate. So I just want to not message that. I don't say you kick them up to the side, but don't put people in a position they're not qualified for. Grooming is important. Mentorship, you said that earlier, is important. But again, we should all be messaging that we should be doing things that we're skilled at. Bottom line. And again, there should never be a person just by default that, oh yeah, Kobe, you might, you know, I used to hang out in the studio with you and I would go get you lunch and I would drive you home. That just by the mere fact that you were in the mix, you get a position. I don't think so, but that's.
I didn't know that you knew Junebug, Tad. I mean, Catherine, I didn't know you knew Junebug.
Oh, Junebug. There's a Junebug in every community. I'm on every block. There's a Junebug on every block. You know that.
That's cool.
But we have to be business stewards of our community and messaging that we empower each other by holding us to a certain bar and a certain standard. And Ian and Byron can attest to the fact that I took chances on people. But because I took a chance, I didn't put people in position they weren't ready for. When they were ready for position, I put them in the position because they earned it. And when I couldn't do any more from them, I'm the greatest asset of a good leader is being willing to release somebody when you know that they've hit a ceiling where you are. And I will never stop somebody from doing great wherever that is. And we will always be a community, and they will always be my family. Because I understood that BMI was not the final stop for Ian. BMI was not the final stop for Byron. There were greater callings on them. And I never took offense to that. I know leaders who like, oh, I put you on it. You're going to leave. They ain't that vested. It ain't my company. Love them dearly. And we still talk often. But understand that if you pour in and you can release them to do what they were called to do, that's your greatest gift as a leader. And too many Black people don't own that. They feel like they own people. I don't own anything but good shoes and handbags.
we've seen, ma'am. We've seen.
Just really quick, I wanted to Eddie, to your point, the hot shit scenario, that song, and that happens. That's twice a month in this business now. It definitely is. Don't be afraid to ask questions. You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the things that young managers need to do. They need to get on the phone. And you have a PRO in Atlanta. You have a Catherine in Atlanta. You have people in LA. Because usually, that 9 times out of 10, that song's coming out of the South or it's coming out of the West.
That's it.
So a lot of times, use your resources. So if you are sitting on the next hot shit or whatever it is, please use your local resources at the end of the day. Because, you know, it's funny because I go into certain labels now and I sit there and I see it's a bunch of kids with laptops that are literally sitting there And all they do is they just wait for the next hot shit to get there. And then somebody's going to go ahead and, like a vulture, come get your next hot shit, and they're going to throw a check at you, and they're going to steal your ownership, and they're going to do this. And literally, I'm not calling out labels, but you can walk into an orchard or whatever, and you can just see that's the new version of A&R.
Mm-hmm.
It's searching for the next hot shit. So please, to those kids who are close to the writer, to the producer, use your local resources, talk to Catherine, like, she's there. Talk to her new buyer. And at the end of the day, she's not going to try to steal your copyright, brother. She's going to help you get and grow your business, direct you to a good attorney, and keep the record, keep those royalties within the community so you can kind of build your business at the end of the day. Use your local resources.
Sean, one thing I want to – I know I'm talking a lot, but I want to make sure people understand that there's been a big I call it purging. There's a lot of catalog sales that's happening across the country. What does that mean? There was an era in the 60s where a lot of the African-American artists they basically, their catalogs were purchased for peanuts that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. In the last 5 years, I've been privy to just way more catalog sales of Black people that is troubling in one respect, because I feel like at the end of the day, you have insurance companies that are in the game, you have banks that are in the game buying catalogs, you have publishers who started, and then the other ancillary industries saw how profitable it was, and you had them now buying into catalog sales. Understand that there will be a time where you can sell, and I know a country artist who's on his third sale, but the expedience in which he's been able to write hits and cash out and then write another, you know, 10, 12 songs and cash out, I've not seen that level of expedience for our community to some extent. A lot of people are selling in distress, meaning, you know, at a multiple that they could have gotten at the pinnacle of 15 or 10, whatever, a multiple of the value of the catalog. I want us to understand that it happens, right, wrong, or indifferent, whatever decisions are for people to sell the catalog. But I think we're losing our footing of our music and how we will be able to control what our music is used for. Conceivably, a Sean Garrett song, and I'm not saying he sold, but it's public knowledge he did, could be used at a KKK rally because it's not his content anymore. So understand the implications of it. We now, who have created and built a certain sound, we're giving it up to entities that are not us to say that they message it, and it's important. But I think we also just need to understand the implications of that for copyright owners on this call. Yeah, there's a big check involved, but it's a dangerous precedent.
We need to have one of these conversations. What Catherine's touching on is much deeper than that, because that is pervasive going on. We should ask a whole separate kind of another webinar, catalog sales, because this is happening.
We don't
hold shit. Part two.
That's another part two. Because Merc is out here snatching it up.
Well, I would say,
and banks.
I've been getting that a lot. Well, luckily for, I won't say luckily, but the way the law is written for us, we have to pay the artists directly. So artists tell me all the time, they come to me like, oh, I got to do this over here, and I got to pay this person, and I got to recoup some costs over here. Our position is, I'm going to send you your money. You do with it what you want to do with it. You're right, Catherine. That's been bubbling up. I mean, like, this week, big hip-hop artists called me. One legend, one current. And was just talking about, like, somebody approached them to get a piece of... And you know what they really want, too? They want them hits. Like, they told them, I don't want your old catalog. I just want that shit that's gonna live forever. That, you know, that royalties. I'm like, you are living off of royalties right now. You ain't touring another. That's what you earn that. So I said, look, well, I got to pay you directly. I can't, you know, divert it somewhere else. But that is a problem. You're right, Tab. That's a whole nother. There you go. Your next webinar, Eddie.
There we go. Thanks, Tab.
And to chime in on that, I was dealing with that today, too. like half of my day was dealing with that with a very notable producer I signed about a year and a half ago. He can't even sell his catalog because we did a deal with him, but he's selling his royalty stream. And just the fact that we're giving up this stuff, you know, the creatives are giving up this stuff, just sets a tone that it's a feeding frenzy. The vultures are out, you know, they're looking for any type of, you know, way in, and you know, they're looking for hits, and it's crazy. It's a different playing field the way things are right now.
Yeah, I want to give Kobe looked like he wanted to say something, and then I'll give.
Interesting you talk about this because it's not much different than the first major catalog, or at least record catalog to ever exist, that being Motown. And, you know, and we're talking about a company that the masters were sold for $60 million. We're not talking about the publishing. Masters alone were sold for $60 million. So in my world, I think about sampling, and I think about an artist like Willie Hutch, who was signed to Motown. Or I think about the Jackson 5, who in order to leave Motown, the Jackson 5 had to forfeit all future earnings. So anytime you sample Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 from Motown, they received no royalty payment. So they took a big gamble leaving Motown. But for $60 million, that catalog was sold. And Willie Hutch is an artist who never really had a hit on Motown, but he's had hits with UGK, and Pimp C and Bun B on international players, and Outkast.
Dre.
Right? Yeah. He had a hit on Usher's album with Superstar, his song from the Mac. He had a couple other hits with 3-6 Mafia. I mean, countless hits from records that were never even singles. So that goes to speak to the power of catalog. I was fortunate enough to go to school with guys whose parents may have written songs in the past. I got one buddy from college whose father wrote a record called Shaboom Shaboom. It's been in cars, it's been in countless commercials. We could probably turn on the TV in 3 months, it'll be in another national ad campaign. Well, this is a song. One song has paid for my friend to go to college, his three children to go to college. I mean, we're talking about generational wealth created by something as simple as one song. So it's really the greatest asset, again, that you could ever own, and something that you should really consider if you're going to get into business. Because the careers are going to become shorter and shorter, but a hit record lasts forever.
Byron, if you have something, look like you have something to say, go ahead.
When I was at BMI, that was a scenario that I saw a lot. And I feel like at least they were coming to get help. I dealt with a lot of managers that, you know, they were in that same situation. They were trusted by the writer, the producer, or the artist. So, you know, they were at that point, you know, representing them, but they would use BMI and use their relationship to ask questions and get answers. And I would connect them with people. And that's kind of why it's important to get affiliated, you know, and get connected with your BMI or your ASCAP or whoever you're with, you know, so that you can have that foundation. And then when you get to the point where you're really taking off, you know, you can get referrals. You know, it's nothing for us to refer you to people that fit. And that management piece is so important because I don't think artists and writers, people realize that person is a representation, is an extension of you. And you want to make sure you're being represented accordingly, because that's going to determine a lot of your success. You know, if you're not represented by someone that, you know, people want to deal with, that could definitely be a hindrance on your career and you progressing and moving forward in the business. So I think you should really utilize, you know, your BMI and get connected for situations like that, especially.
I want to segue into taking a few live questions. We have probably about 10 people that have already put their hands up. Let's start with Avi Cantor. Let's see if that would get that going.
We good? Everybody can hear me? Good?
Yeah.
Hey, man, what's going on, everybody?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I appreciate you guys having me. My name is Avi. I'm from Philly. I'm a content creator and writer, and I'm an intern with Cloth, who you know, Eddie, from one of the panels before at Luxury Music Group. And I just wanted to ask you guys, you know, when you're facing adversity in the industry, how do you know when it's time to shift your focus to something different, or if you can, if you should continue to pursue your goal?
Anybody can jump in on that.
I think if you're very passionate about what you do, you stick to it, and yeah, you may shift, you may move into a different aspect of the industry. But I think all of us here had a calling of sorts to be involved in music, whether it be writing music, producing music, serving executives, serving as administrators. In some way, shape, or form, it's integral and definitely central to who we are, because that desire, that passion, and that calling also radiates into other things. I mean, it's interesting. We continue to go back to Catherine, likely because she's the woman in the room. But when we came on, we have gentlemen speaking about the impact and influence they had. That means that she's much more. Her calling is much greater than being in the music industry. Her calling involves mentoring. It involves pouring into other people. She could do that as a school teacher, a school administrator, a doctor, an attorney, but music became the conduit through which she does that. Just, I mean, and I'm speaking on almost on your behalf. You may
no, but you that's prophetic, because so much of what you said was really dead on. I didn't pursue music; music pursued me. But what I understood is that God trusted me with a platform, and I had to do right by the platform. And you know, coming into the game, you know, in the mid late 90s, understanding first job at the Grammys, second job BMI, so I've only had two jobs. I didn't intern. You know, I was very fortunate to start in very high level positions at both companies. It was a great amount of pressure, but I think my early days, I had to really come to terms with the responsibility of the pressure. And once I understood the responsibility, it became less of a pressure and more of a mission and a calling. And I think I use that word often, so you tap right in. So the young man that talked about struggling and what that meant, what that means, you can't be great if you're not struggling. If you ever pursued anything that's worth having, I can't imagine anybody on this call that said it didn't come with some shit, some disappointments and some challenges and the things that you go home at night and you have to sit up and process. But you have to wake up every day and understand that yesterday was yesterday. Today is a new day for me to really do something great. And that was always my mantra. I don't live in what happened yesterday. I believe we all have been put here. We all have an assignment. Make sure you understand what your assignment is. Sometimes people pursue things thinking that that's their assignment, and it really isn't. That's your desire, but is that your God-given purpose? And I don't ever want to say to somebody, and I have many times I've had kids come in the room and like, I want you to mentor me, and I don't have time, but I will do my best in whatever framework that is to mentor. Byron was somebody I mentored because I understood that God could trust him with the gift. Ian, at a time in his career where he was at a pivot, I knew that Ian was somebody I can trust with the gift. There'll be people I've trusted with the gift that didn't deserve it, but do I ever hold that? No, I understand that that was a part of the process. So young man, know it's good, bad, and ugly. A lot of good, more ugly, and some bad, but it's all a part of what will make your muscle strong. So.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Avi.
Appreciate you guys.
Have a good one, brother.
You too.
Let's go to Jay Castro.
Jay has been on here popping, talking.
Jay, what's good?
Hey, man, thank you guys for having this. You've been, Eddie, you've been putting this together for a few days, and I've been in and out of them, checking them all the time. And I want to thank you guys for joining us as well and giving your knowledge, because it means a lot to all of us here.
Appreciate it.
Well, Paul, I'm going to have a question. So I'm working on releasing an EP, and I've been talking to some distribution companies, And they were talking about, I came across one who wants to take like 30% of all the, supposedly because they distribute the music, but they want to get 30% of all the earnings. And I wanted to find out what you guys think about that. They're serving as like a marketing type of distributing company.
Yeah, Eddie? I mean, I can definitely answer that. Dang, thanks, Captain. What if I didn't want to answer it?
Eddie?
For us in our business model over at AWOL, we have basically three different tier levels of service. We have our just regular distribution platform, which is a smaller percentage, which is a 85-15 split. We have a second tier level, which we call AWOL Plus, which is obviously a step up on a project, on a term that we'd like to, you know, have a certain number of songs in. And with that, we increase the level of percentage up to 25%, so 75-25 split, because we're offering more services. And then when you get to the top level of our AWOL recordings, where we've had artists like Omar Apollo, Snow Allegra, et cetera, et cetera. That's when you get the full suite of our services. So marketing, digital accounts, and marketing will encompass digital marketing and product manager, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of the ceiling. And some of those fluctuate every now and then, depending upon the scenario. But usually if we're taking a larger cut, it's because we're giving more service. So I can only assume whichever distribution company that you're speaking to, that's probably why. But again, that's just an assumption.
Okay, all right.
Cool.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you guys, and appreciate you guys, and I'll keep doing my research on it. But thank you guys for having us.
All right, brother. Stay safe. Let's go with Cass Weinbrunn.
Thank you.
What's up, Cass?
What's going on? How are you doing? Couple of things. First of all, I'm a trained musician. I came from the church. So I started when I was five. So I really, really believe that music is actually from God, you know? And I feel like God inspired the Beatles, which inspired Apple Computer to invent Zoom, to see that now we're here. Come together, as the Beatles say. You know what I mean? And I think that's what he really wanted in this, for me to celebrate my family's Passover, because I'm Jewish, but I mean, together via Zoom, but also to see all the musicians playing on the Zoom big band lives, you know, I mean, music's for me is my passion and my training, and I'm an educator, I teach. My whole entire thing is the non-transparency, but yet the transparency of the numbers. When all these public companies are benefiting off the artist, you know, like that's the number, you know, there's valuation where an artist like myself can see that he has 22.3 million streams. You know, is there something to say about that? Because of my understanding, I've also done a lot of stuff in the hip hop world and whatnot. I worked with really cool records, but I again did this for the right reasons, you know, for my training, my studying Bach, you know, studying Gershwin, trying to be like Gershwin one day, you know, working with a lot of different artists, you know, and getting the lucky call directly. So, you know, I would love to see a way that we could figure out, you know, to help the artists directly, you know, individually, so everybody could win together and be inspired to make music, you know, via this social revolution as Paul McCartney inspired, you know. Yeah. And thank you again for putting this on, and lucky I got onto this one.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. Thank you for your comment and your feedback. Tab, you got something?
I was just applauding him. That was dope.
No, appreciate same it. Here. Brilliant. A
love
study,
to you.
And it's refreshing to see people take their craft seriously. And to me, that resonates even through the Zoom, that you are a study of the game, and people like yourself will be ahead of the game because you are a study of the game.
Yeah, I'm a musicologist at first. My heroes are jazz musicians. Jazz, and jazz is another world. You know, jazz is such a harmony between, you know, Bill Evans and Miles Davis, you know. And I actually, my biggest hits are samples of jazz music, you know, jazz itself, you know. So, you know, it's like, I mean, to see those guys, to see Smalls and Fat Cat suffer, you know.
Yeah. Well, appreciate your comments and your feedback. And thanks for tuning in.
Appreciate you.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
We'll take a few more. We are, as usual, gone over time, but you know, when you're getting all this great information, sometimes you just gotta let it rock. We'll take three more questions, and let's start with Justine. Okay. Hi, Justine.
Hi. How are you? Hi, I'm Justine. Nice to meet you.
You too.
So I had a few questions about.
Well, give us one.
Okay. Well, it's about pitch and demos. This is directed to the A&Rs mostly. In your experience, have you found that like full songs, fully mixed, plays better? Is it easier to shop, or is it better to have like really great hooks, but like maybe leave more room for the artist, you know, for the verses and things like that? And when you're pitching this and you're discussing this with artists, like what are you looking for mostly? Like how can we increase our chances of placements is pretty much the question.
I'll jump in on my side. What I suggest to my songwriters and even writers who don't belong to, you know, the company that I'm at, when you're playing music for folks, sorry, there's a dog that's crying in the background. When you're playing music for folks, I always think of it as you got to spoon feed people. So you want to do it as if you're about to release it yourself. So get the best mix. I take full songs. And now what I do is I, you know, the A&R in me comes out when I'm playing it for different people. You know, there's ways that we can chop it up. If you like something that's something of the song, you know, that really sticks out to you, just take that piece. We'll go back and get the track. You know, we'll make it work however we can. But the best way I can put it is, get the best material from gate, because your first impression might be your last impression, and you want to do it as if you're about to release it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, and can we get a replay of this? Like,
absolutely. It'll be available.
That is awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Justine. Stay safe.
You too. Everybody here too.
All right. We'll go with two more. Next person is Cam Johnson. Hi, Cam.
Hey, how's it going? Appreciate you guys for having this. I'm a manager and up and coming A&R, and I mainly manage producers. My question was, if a producer has like millions and millions of streams on YouTube, and I'm not saying millions and millions, but he has like videos with 700,000 streams, multiple ones, how do we get compensated from that as far as from the YouTube? We can go through the PRO. And through the artists, I know we have somebody on from Sound Exchange. So if you guys could have to speak to that from a PRO perspective, and what do you guys think YouTube plays as far as discovery as well for producer side?
It just depends on the share. We pay 200%, 100% to the writer, and then 100% to the publisher. So it's 100 and 100. And then if there's two or three writers, that's divided. YouTube's numbers are still really small in terms of what you see for the volume, the number of streams. Absolutely make sure you register with the PRO. I think people believe, well, I registered and I'm good, but they don't register the song. So registering means you have to have an online account and register the works of that person. And then it generally is about 3/4 for us, or most PROs, before you see money. That's still not a lot of money at 700, but collectively, when you start seeing billions of streams is where you start seeing money, but that's just on the digital side. If there's radio and play or other mediums by which the music is being heard, you'll start to see little money trickling in. But right now, still, traditional radio is still the biggest hit in terms of money. But the ownership piece, the larger the share, the more money your creatives are going to see. But I think you did the right thing by registering with the PRO. We can't hear you.
I say, yeah, we have SongTrust, and that's supposed to cover everything. That's like supposed to be our collection agency. And like he's registered with BMI as far as the songwriter, the producer. So I guess we just have to wait on that process.
How recent? When did you register them? Is it been pretty recent?
January, like end of January.
So it's early. They probably won't start seeing money probably until September, about three quarters in. So
okay, that is what they expected. I just was trying to make sure that was industry standard. And I just appreciate you guys for your help.
Thank you.
I'll just add real quick. We in the interest of time, I'll run through it and not to hijack the webinar. But we pay artists, like I said earlier, we paid artists and rights owners directly. However, when the law was written, everybody in the creative process wasn't actually included in the bill. So there's a concession that we do at Sound Exchange where we will pay producers with the LOD. A letter of direction. So you just get a letter from the artist saying, Cam gets 10% of this song and then we'll pay you out. You'll be fine. But also the Music Modernization Act, I don't know if you're familiar with that, the MMA, it was passed at the end of 2018. That righted a lot of wrongs. And it also included a provision for audio, producers and engineers. So, I know we ran out of time.
That letter of direction, I seen that on there. Would that come from a label? So if a song, a guy has a song that he dropped to a label and used our beat for that LOD, would it come directly from the artist?
Or would that come from the artist? It would come from the artist. Whoever is the featured artist on that track, or if it's a collab or how many people, they have to send in a letter. And it's just a little form that say you get, X percentage of that particular track.
Gotcha.
It only happens in hip hop and R&B, our music, because it's like it's the genres that the producers are very popular and sometimes make the songs bigger than what they are. I very rarely see this in other genres, but this is a hip hop and R&B sort of deal where, gotcha. The producer that sometimes drives the track, drives the popularity.
Right. Okay, definitely. I'm going to look up the MMA Act. I appreciate you guys.
Yeah, you got it, Cam.
Right. Thanks, Cam.
Great.
All right, last person. Let's go with Donovan Johnson.
What's going on? What's going on? Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, perfect. Oh, you can't see me? Well, okay, there you go. You see me?
What's good, bro?
Hey,
how about you?
What's going on? Just want to say first and foremost, thank you guys for having this amazing panel. It's very enlightening and very insightful. So I want to say thank you for that. I'm an artist manager out of Toronto. I manage an artist by the name of Corduroy Floyd. So whenever you guys get a chance, check it out. But my main question is, since obviously we have to pivot from any type of touring or anything right now, what would be some good ways for an independent artist to get sync placements? Right, what would be a good way for them to leverage the any type of views or anything that they have in order to get sync placements on, whether it be movie, TV, or video games?
Anybody want to jump in?
I can jump in. It's probably not the most technical way, but just to the way that I comment on that from my experience, I've spent time as a manager as well too. So just based off of my experience and probably at the stage that you're at now, like I did a lot of research. So all the shows that I used to watch, I'd find out who the who the music director was. I'd go on Facebook. I'd do my due diligence and just really trying to figure out a way to how to build a relationship with them directly and get the music. Will they all respond? No. But you keep digging, you'll get somebody to respond. Somebody that's open to getting new music. And let's keep this in mind. They want music that isn't tied to publishing companies, that isn't tied to major recording labels, because there's a lot less red tape. From a major publisher standpoint or from where I'm at now, it's tough to answer that because I deal with my songwriters. And I think we mentioned on the call earlier, with COVID, things have shifted. So some companies aren't even in production until this kind of shifts a little bit. So, yeah, from an independent standpoint, it does not cause harm to just try to build these relationships individually during these times. That, you know, I've done it. I've had success. And you want to take the chance of building your network that way too.
Dope. Thank you. Yeah. I'll keep digging.
If I could also add, I would not overlook the possibility of local vendors. I mean, there have to be businesses that can leverage and benefit from whatever following your artists. Man, it's weird because I don't see you, but I know you're here. But yeah, they can benefit. And that's, I mean, part of telling a story. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And as things begin to open up again, if you can tell this story of how you've gotten some sync placements locally, then that may translate to whoever it is you're also, as Ian suggested, fostering relationships with during this quiet time and say, hey, you know, follow us. When you're open again, I don't know what you're doing, I think this is something you should be interested in coming out of Toronto.
And I'll also add, Shopify is in Canada. I think it's Ontario, but don't quote me. They're paying buttloads of money for Instagram placements or social media placements. I wouldn't even relegate it to Instagram. And so Canada is a very fluid market. And I think so many times people outside the US spend so much time chasing the business and money here, and it's already pretty crowded with people who are working from here. It's much easier to try to get money in your own country. So look at some of your local resources. Shopify, I just bought some stock. Very pricey, but they're making tons of money. Their valuation is through the roof, and they're spending a ton of money. I was a part of a deal. They gave somebody $100,000 for two posts. All they wanted them to do is post, and they were giving away money for the post. So the creative got $100,000. They put a post only on their story and took it down the next day. So look at some of your local entities for these type of opportunities. They're there, trust me. And Canada is a big film market.
So yeah, those are some really good jewels right there. I just saw the Shopify stock pretty much rise from 500 to the 700s.
Crazy.
In a day, in 24 hours. Yeah, so.
Catherine got some bread to spend.
That's a good look, but I'll definitely do that.
But again, it goes to, you know, casting a broader net. And, you know, we are all in a position where, you know, look at what's in your back door. Sometimes we're chasing things around the globe when there's real money. And Shopify is really going to be a player for some time to come. The market is showing it. They've been Teflon Don. And funny enough, in a weird way, because I really wasn't even aware of them until 6 months ago.
Yeah, they kind of cornered the market first, but I know, you know, time is short and everything's running out, so I just want to say once again, the artist that I manage is Corduroy Floyd with a K, so, you know, guys, feel free to check him out. He's very dope. He's worked with Mike Hector out of L.A., who produced for Kendrick and Omarion and so on and so forth, but thank you so much once again for all the, you know, the dope information. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Donovan, there's a friend of mine in Toronto named Melissa McAllister. I'm not sure if you know her, but she does a lot of stuff in the Toronto area. And she also does.
I know of her.
Okay, she does a lot of music placement.
Okay, I'm gonna have to hit her up then, for sure.
Yeah. She knows a lot of folks. I work with her. But yeah, dope. Nice meeting you, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
All right, brother.
Nice to meet you, too.
Stay safe.
Peace. Amen.
Peace. There we have it. Another one in the books. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank Sean and Kobe and Byron and Tab and Catherine and Ian for joining and taking now 2 hours out of your evening. I know that obviously we're all in the house and, you know, we still have things to do.
Yeah, man, I gotta go to the living room, man. Damn.
Yeah. But look, before we get out of here and Tab, we did this the last one you were on. We got a big versus this weekend. Jill Scott versus Erykah Badu. Everybody has 30 seconds. We're gonna go around the room, and Miss the Queen has the last word, as it should be. Sean, 30 seconds. Who gets it? Jill or Erykah?
you know damn well I cannot pick because you are recording this and they both my people. So we all are the winners. We all are the winners.
That goes without saying. That's the disclaimer.
I'm not you. I see you wearing a wire, man. I can't do this, man.
All right, we're going to let you get that pass. Kobe.
They're both remarkable songwriters, artists, and symbols of their time.
Everybody want to be politically correct. Byron.
I mean, can you really pick a winner?
Good luck. Yes.
You don't get a pass because you showed up. Listen, you're going to be a winner.
So let me just stop right here because everybody wants to be politically correct. We did it, and Tab can attest, we did this with Babyface and Teddy Riley. So there's no difference. And everybody picks somebody.
Oh, yeah, okay. I mean, Jill different. Scott, I love Jill Scott, but, you know, I think for this battle, I think Erykah Badu is gonna probably come with me.
Yeah.
Tab.
I mean, that's tough, you know, and I'm not going to be political and say the culture is going to win at the end of the day, but look, I might have my Pinot Noir ready to go, but I'm going with Erykah. I'm going with Badu.
I think it's not a hard call for me. I love Jill. You know, I rock with all the Hidden Beach folks from the days of me and you. Absolutely. Eddie, we're back in the Sony building on the label side. But damn, Erykah, man, like, are you kidding me? I think we all know, man. I got too many fond memories, too many nostalgic moments to not give it up to Erykah, man. Even just the energy when you see, I don't know if anybody's seen her live.
Yeah,
recently. No, but it's still magic. It still draws you in from top to bottom. Badu, Miss Badu.
I'm going with Erykah because we share the same initials, EB.
I got my initials ready.
And the deal is still
the last
Catherine.
No, my boy said it. Badu all the way. Team Badu.
Oh, true. Hey, who gonna do You Got Me? Does everybody know the story behind that? Everybody knows that story, right?
That's a good one.
Well, everybody knows that story.
But for those who don't, you tell the story, and then we'll get out of here.
Real quick, like, Jill recorded it first. They had to hurry up. You know, the label was like, you know, they had Erykah's word, so they had her to get it. So Erykah did the song again. So the Roots was like, yo, Jill, this is the one. This is the one. They's like, nah, we need to go with something more established. So that's why Jill's album is called. They was like, who is Jill Scott? That's why the album is named Who is Jill Scott? Because of that song. Like, I don't know who gonna do the verse. I don't know who gonna do that song.
They gotta throw that one out. I didn't know that part, about who is Jill Scott. I knew about the
verse. Thank y'all. I love you all. You guys are amazing. Jumping.
Thank you so much, Catherine. We appreciate
you. Eddie, thank you. Eddie, I didn't know. I mean, I just got the wire. Thanks for paying for me to be here, man. I didn't think it was going to be this much, man.
You break me off, Sean.
You got to break me off because they ain't paid me.
We got to go. The static.
I need you to be a loser.
I got to go.
Bye, guys.
Thank you all.
Y'all be safe, man.
Take care, guys.